Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Steve Phillips, author of How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. Steve Phillips is a New York Times bestselling author, columnist, and national political thought leader. He is the author of the New York Times and Washington Post bestselling Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New Majority, as well as How We Win the War. And Steve, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
So when I saw the title of the book, I had to read it because it brought to mind a trigger word for me. And that trigger word is whenever I hear the word states' rights or the phrase states' rights. Because that trigger word to me means they're going back to do something that is going to take away rights or privileges of an oppressed community based on their belief that it's within a state's rights. And of course, being familiar with the Civil War, that ended up as a, you know, got reacquainted with from reading your book. That was the new narrative that was promoted as, of course, to the real narrative. I had opportunity to read the articles of secession. And of course, slavery was at the top of the list. But in your book, you write, first thing, I'm trying to sound the alarm that our opponents are engaged in a continuation of the Civil War, have just recently tried to destroy democracy and move us into fascism, and are actively at work to do it again. So when I think about that phrase, I think people don't realize that there is the actual Civil War itself, and then there's a propaganda war. And then there was an assault on the legislation to give more freedom and privileges to Black Americans. But you start the book off in your introduction, you start off with the attempt at an insurrection on January 6th.
Right.
So talk a little bit about how you pulled this book together, because you both look at the long history of the continuous assault on the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, voting rights, et cetera. And then you also, fortunately, you map out a path using examples of places like state of Texas, Arizona, San Diego, on how to win this, this what I would call a voting war. But talk a little bit to me about how you ended up putting this book together.
Yeah, so you mentioned my first book, Brown is the New White, and they kind of go together to a certain extent. So I am quite literally a child of the civil rights movement, right? I've been born in the 1960s. Grew up in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, and they wouldn't sell the home to my parents because they were Black. I had to get a white civil rights lawyer to deed it over. And I was always very so influenced by the milieu of the civil rights movement, and connected and identified with that tradition and that lineage. I read all the biographies of Martin Luther King in my elementary school. And I came out of the Black church tradition. My grandfather was a minister, 50 years of Glenville Church of God. So a formative political experience for me that kind of led and shaped the analysis for both of these books were the Jesse Jackson's presidential campaigns in the 1980s and the Rainbow Coalition effort, which both directly tied to the civil rights movement and then built a movement on that. I mean, Jesse's campaign went to the church leaders and the community groups and the unions and built a political force. So it was very clear, it seemed obvious to me, frankly, that when Obama had got won, it was building on that tradition and that building on that foundation, as well as the demographic revolution. Right? Actually, if I went back and ran the numbers, Obama would not have beaten Reagan with the percentages of Black voters and white voters that he got, because there just weren't enough people of color at that point in time in the country's composition. So I wrote the first book to try to distill the lessons and the importance of how Obama won and what the implications were of that for moving forward, that there is a new American majority consisting of the majority of people of overwhelming majority of people of color, and then I call a meaningful minority of whites. And that's what people should be doubling down on in terms of moving forward. So that was 2016. I tried to write it before the 2016 election, try to lift up and illuminate a pathway in that regard. Then my publisher came to me in April of 2020 and asked if I was interested in writing another book. And so clearly we were far into the Trump administration. And I started out and I was posing this as a metaphor. And I was like, well, what if we looked at this current moment in time through the prism of the metaphor of the Civil War? And that was April. And so then you get, you know, 8-9 months later, you have people carrying the Confederate flag, wearing sweatshirts saying MAGA Civil War 2021, storming the United States Capitol to stop the peaceful transfer of power. And I'm like, well, this is not so metaphorical anymore. And so then as I began to dig deeper in terms of making the argument, doing more research and looking really at how the Confederacy and its ideological and genealogical successors had operated, you could see a very clear through line where they had quite literally never stopped fighting. And so that I thought was very clarifying and important for us to understand this political moment. I mean, succession that led to the Civil War came about because the candidate who was backed by Black people, the losing side could not accept that election outcome. And they wound up succeeding. We had January 6th. And so you still, and you, to this day, they, you know, Trump and his forces still do not accept the 2020 election. So that fundamental dynamic has played itself out continuously and continually. And so the more I dug into the history, I saw that this is an, in fact, an unbroken through line. This is where the Confederates and their ideological heirs have employed many of the same tactics, what I call the Confederate battle plan, to continue to fight to make this a white nationalist country. And we remain engaged in that battle. Is this going to be a white nationalist country, or is this going to be a multiracial democracy? And then when you see things that way, then I think it becomes clearer what we have to do in 2024 and beyond.
I think we tend to think of with the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act, that that was it. That we were done, but it, excuse me, but also it makes me think of the NAACP when Brown versus Topeka Board of Education Supreme Court decision, or Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision was decided. I remember literally reading someone from the NAACP thinking that the schools would be fully integrated in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that didn't happen. And there was resistance. And I think we kind of forget that the resistance has been there since the end of the Civil War in 1865, you know, from the Black codes to Jim Crow. But also, when you look at that history, the North was complicit.
Yeah.
Because they were so interested in bringing the country back together. As I heard someone else say, they kind of just said, let's push the African-Americans, Blacks, to the side. And that's really illustrated by the deal that was cut in the 1876 election.
Right.
Rutherford B. Hayes, a Republican, the so-called pro-freedom party against Samuel Tilden, the Democrats supported by the Southern Democrats. Neither one gets enough of the Electoral College to win. It goes to the House of Representatives. And then the deal is cut.
Right.
And I'll let you talk about the deal being cut that basically pulled the troops out of the South, knowing that without the troops to protect the recently freed slaves, Blacks, that we would have a reign of terror.
Right. So you tee that up exactly accurately and then also on point. So the second edition of my book is coming out in paperback on March 12th of next year. And for that edition, I've written a new preface that both summarizes the 2022 elections, but also looks forward to 2024. And I open up that preface talking about a conversation that Isabel Wilkerson recounts in her book, Cass, where she was talking to Taylor Branch in 2018, when there were a lot of spate of, you know, white nationalist domestic terrorism in this country. And Taylor Branch asked Wilkerson, where do you think we are? Do you think this is the 1950s? She says, I think it's the 1880s. And so they kind of talk about that. And so I frame the preface by saying, I think we are in 1876. And which is this point where you're talking about the Hayes-Tilden Compromise. So we had, you know, a country founded in unapologetic and ferocious white nationalism and slavery, fought an extraordinarily bloody civil war. People don't realize just how, I mean, it was the equivalent population-wise of if 7 million people would be killed in a war around whether there should be a white nationalist nation or multiracial democracy. And then that was followed by Reconstruction, which itself was greatly resisted at every level. They couldn't even pass the 13th Amendment to outlaw slavery through the House of Representatives at first. They had to do several different revisions of it and take several votes, which was just to outlaw slavery. And this was a House that didn't have the Confederates in it. They had all left the country. So getting this issue around the South, the North being complicit. So we had 10 years of Reconstruction, and then the country had a definitive election. Which direction were we going to go? Were we going to continue to make some steps towards multiracial democracy, as in we were trying to do in Reconstruction? Or were we going to go back to fundamentally the white nationalist framework? And then we had this stalemate, as you describe it. And so it was very similar in that regard as well, in that election, that you had people showing up and protesting at election boards, trying to intimidate the counting of the votes, et cetera. And so the ultimate resolution was this Hayes-Tilden Compromise, which in a kind of fascinating historical arc was brokered by John Brown Gordon of Georgia, which in essence, it was a situation of where the South surrendered their claim on the White House in exchange for getting given back the South to the slaveholders and the former slaveholders. And so, yes, they pulled the troops out of the South. One of the components of the Confederate battle plan I was talking about is silently sanctioned terrorism, and then sometimes not so silent. And so the rise of the Klan, the whole battery of domestic terrorist organizations designed to keep people from voting by both terrorizing and killing them was, accelerated and unchecked. And the other part I talk about is ruthlessly rewriting the rules. So they, restrict democracy, put in all place all of these different measures to stop African-Americans from voting. So in essence, in 1876, the country was handed back to the Confederates, who then held power and ruled over a white nationalist region for nearly 100 years. And so that's also, you see, it's not that hard to draw a through line in terms of the continuity of the Confederacy. So that was a fundamental moment in this country. And I do feel that that's a very similar dynamic. And the extent to which Trump has shredded the social contract and any sense of norms around what kind of society we're going to have, the assaults on and disrespect for the 14th Amendment in terms of its issues around citizenship, et cetera, all of that is on the table, I would argue. And so that's why I do believe that 2024 is very much 1876 and quite literally existential. What kind of nation is this going to be? Are we going to try to move towards making it actually a multiracial democracy that embraces and invests in and lifts up everybody? Or is this going to be fundamentally a white country where few other people are allowed to exist, but not nearly embraced in any sense of equal way?
To some degree, when I think about presidential candidates, and I was born in 1960, that I saw as an adult, Trump reminds me of Patrick Buchanan. Mm. When Patrick Buchanan made a run for the presidency, he was critical of the immigration from countries other than Europe. He felt that this was a white European country. And so he was pretty clear on that, though he didn't make it and win the Republican nomination. But the interesting thing about the success with Trump is it goes back, in my mind, to the success with the election of Obama. Because some of my white friends would tell me things like after Obama got elected, they would say that their people they were around that were white all of a sudden felt more comfortable saying racist things that they were not saying before the election of Obama. And from a progressive perspective, Obama's moderate.
Right.
I mean, he was a moderate president that actually tried to reach to the other aisle. And one of the points you make is we're wasting our time trying to work with the other side because they are in this for the long game. So talk a little bit about whether or not you think this was this. And of course, we have others. You know, you talk about Strom Thurmond. We talk about George Wallace, you know, the Dixiecrats, all these other attempts to bring to the forefront unabashedly white nationalism without necessarily calling it white nationalism.
Right. Yeah. No, it's no accident that Trump followed Obama. And so this was very clear. This one people refer to as a white lash to the election of the first black president. And you saw it, I mean, you've seen it throughout history, right? And so you're talking there about the level of kind of generalized freaking out during Reconstruction around so many black people getting in positions of power. And there's like a book I quote in there, it was like, you know, the members of the legislature are black and the, you know, chaplain is black and the speaker is coal black. And they, you know, this was like, you know, 1860s, people were freaking out at that point in time. I also talk about how when Harold Washington ran for mayor of Chicago, which is an 80% Democratic city, and he nearly lost, they nearly elected a Republican because that person was white, the level at which there was this, again, complete freak out about a black person who might actually be in power. So we had a similar dynamic with Obama. And this whole, you know, Tea Party was just, we should have gotten the memo. We saw the people carrying signs with Obama with like a Hitler mustache. So like, and it's been actually documented by academicians, the racial animus that was running through the whole reaction and response to Obama, white people feeling that like this isn't their country anymore. And so along comes Trump to champion that view. And I think two things have happened in the past, you know, several years that are really very destructive to our society. Trump normalized that viewpoint and that view that white people are under assault and that people of color have too much and are too powerful. You know, they never had somebody as legitimate and high profile as Trump to validate that viewpoint. So you had that. And then with the rise of technology, and it's just as documented, Ben Smith talks about in his book, Traffic, about the all the online issues and then Facebook and how Facebook provided a connecting mechanism. So previously people, you know, they would like sit in the corners of bars or their parents' basements and mutter these racist thoughts. But the internet then connected them and to where they felt like they had a sense of community and they had friends and allies and they weren't alone. And one of the things that's very underappreciated about Trump's election is that it wasn't that there were all these people who defected from the Democrats to go elect Trump. It's that a lot of people who had not previously been voting were enthused and excited and came out and voted in great numbers. And that is because Trump validated them and they had the communication tools to show them that they were, in fact, a force to be reckoned with. And so that very much is what we're grappling with at this political moment.
So let's talk about the propaganda war. And it goes all the way back to 1866, where the term, the book, The Lost Cause. And as you know, I already mentioned earlier, when I look at the Articles of Secession, it clearly states slavery. When you look at why Texas wanted to break away from Mexico, in large part because of slavery, yet they have rewritten the narrative to try to mythologize the story behind states' rights. And what's even worse about reading Karen Cox's book, which you cited earlier, and reading about the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the monuments and the textbooks. I mean, this has really been a generational, multiple generations where they have produced this myth about the lost cause. Talk a little bit about how that has influenced where we are today.
Yes, very much so. And that, you know, I kind of reference it in the book by talking about the, you know, Trump's big lie about the election 2020 was stolen and that how really, if you look at any kind of evidence, how absurd that is. And I was like, well, is that a very crazy thing to think? But I'm like, well, is it that much more crazy than to redefine the what was in fact a treasonous white nationalist rebellion into a glorious romantic cause to preserve heritage and history and culture. And so it was a sustained and is a sustained and multidimensional multimedia effort to change public opinion around that. And that's one of the elements of the conservative, the Confederate battle plan that I talk about is distorting public opinion. And so you had Jefferson Davis, who was one of the who was the the losing presidential candidate, writing this long piece on the Lost Cause. There's a book on the Lost Cause. The group you mentioned, United Daughters of the Confederacy, were quite literally what their name said, daughters of Confederates who have remained. There are still 700 chapters of UDC around the country. They put up on their website after George Floyd was murdered, trying to say that they're not a racist organization. I was like, it's in your name, right? In terms of who you actually are. And so but UDC was very, very active in particularly on the turn of the century around monitoring the what was being taught in the schools. And we're seeing this play itself out now again in terms of how things are actually going on. And so they were banned books that were critical of the Confederacy, and they really wanted to shape the minds of what influenced children as they move forward. And so in education, you get in that realm, and in culture and in popular culture, right? And so both started out as a play, which Uncle Tom's Cabin was a, sympathetic to the abolitionist movement play. And they were unhappy with that. And so wound up writing originally a play, Birth of a Nation, which was originally called The Klansman. And then it was made into a movie, Birth of a Nation, which really was about the how glorious and noble the Confederate cause was. And so not only was this made into a movie that got a lot of critical review, et cetera, but it was, I believe, the first, certainly an early movie that was screened in the White House. The president has roots in the South. And so you have that. And then those books and plays that Dixon had done, author of Birth of a Nation, influenced Margaret Mitchell, who wrote Gone with the Wind. And that was the really crowning cinematic tour de force to completely redefine what had been war around whether Black people could buy and sell Black human beings into this romantic quest, and Scarlett O'Hara and Rhett Butler and all of this kind of nostalgia. And was it, there was it premiered in Atlanta. Margaret Mitchell's from Georgia. Georgia only had 4 million people in the state at the time. 1 million people came out to see for the unveiling and the debut of Birth of a Nation. And even as late as 2016, it was still one of the top most admired books within the country. And it is nothing less than an apology for white nationalist treason. But they've repackaged it in ways that make that whole cause far more palatable. And that is a core component of this Confederate battle plan that continues to this day through Trump and his big lie around 2020.
When you were doing your research on the propaganda war going up until the 1950s, was there anything that you found particularly egregious that you said, oh my God, I can't believe that this was going on? I know there's probably a litany of those things. I mean, just the mere fact that it was going on. And I think the other thing I want you to talk about is how we tend to not be conscious of it. Like, we kind of live in today, but I think there's an old saying, I'm sure I got this wrong, he who does not remember his past is condemned to repeat it.
Right.
And if we don't pay attention to the ongoing or realize there's been a propaganda campaign going on since the end of the Civil War that influenced the textbooks, you had people going to the textbook companies, having them change the text.
Yeah.
And of course, here in Texas, they've banned critical race theory. And of course, I'm like, critical race theory. I remember reading about that with Derrick Bell some 30 years ago.
Right,
they're not
right.
teaching critical race theory in schools. They're teaching Black history.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, I'll say two things that really surprised me in the research. Well, one was the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And they have a wing of the organization called Children of the Confederacy. And this is actually still on their website, United Daughters of the Confederacy. And they have a catechism in this where they indoctrinate children around the history of the country and the history of the Civil War. And then I was able to get copies of earlier versions of this catechism, one of which talks about this. It's kind of a little bit of a question and answer type of piece in terms of what was the war about. And it was, and then basically and then saying in there that, you know, this, most of the slaves were happy. And did we kill many Yankees? Yes. Thousands and thousands of them. That's the, that was the correct response in the catechism, to have children celebratory talking about killing thousands and thousands of what they're calling Yankees, who are really Americans trying to keep, make this country a multiracial democracy. And they continue this catechism to this day. It's actually on their website, or at least they reference it. So, which also talks about slaves essentially being happy and being treated well, et cetera. So that was fairly eye-opening. The other thing was how, not just how mainstream and popular the Ku Klux Klan was, and that there were the equivalent of millions of people in terms of today's population who were part of the Klan, particularly early as the, in around the 1920s, senators, governors, high-ranking, you know, leaders with respect to people within this country, to the extent of which there was an effort by some people to pass a resolution in both of the political parties' conventions in 1924 condemning the Klan, and they could not do that. And they did not have the votes at either Republican or Democratic convention to condemn the Klan in the 1920s. It was that politically powerful of an operation. And so we think of it as like a few bad apples who wear these robes, et cetera, but it was a mainstream force. And we have continued to underestimate and appreciate the tenacity and breadth of white nationalists, terrorists, and their sympathizers and defenders.
I want to go back to the popularity of the movie Gone with the Wind. The most biggest box office, domestic box office, has been the Star Wars, the first reboot of Star Wars a few years ago, $936 million. And today's dollars, Gone with the Wind's gross would be $1.8 billion. Right. So we have this propaganda film that is incredibly popular, that huge communities are buying into. And to me, it's just astounding how easy it is for the general population, even knowing that more than half the Republicans believe that Trump won the election.
Right.
Knowing, and you're a lawyer, knowing that how many cases were filed contesting the election and how many actually won, like 300 or 400 cases and not a single one, with all these Republican appointed judges, yeah, Trump appointed judges, Bush appointed judges, not a single one. They didn't win a single one. This is, right. I don't get sort of this mass, for want of a better term, mass hallucination, this mass belief of something that, believe me, with the, so many Republicans appointed as judges, if there was a hole there, they would have won something.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what's so fascinating about how public opinion gets shaped, how ideas get shaped through propaganda, through culture, through, you know, quote unquote news, right? And so obviously Fox News being echo chamber that parrots basically Trump's views and this, you know, reactionary mindset that white people are under attack is fairly, you know, widespread and ubiquitous in a lot of conservative circles. So you have that, and then you have all the online, as mentioned, the Facebook, and people get their own groups, their own circles of people. And so misinformation and disinformation can get widely spread in that capacity. And so that really is, I think, a fundamental aspect of what we're dealing with. And you know, I'm saying also on the legal front, all these different cases, not being able to find, but it's, you know, I quote, I found this quote from Mein Kampf and Hitler, right? And it's saying, how can it be where something that's so obviously not true gets embraced by so many people? And I said, ask Hitler. And he wrote about this in Mein Kampf, right? And says that most people tell little lies, right? Oh yeah, I like the food you had, or I can't come over because I've got something else going on. And so they relate to small lies, but they can't even conceptualize telling a massive lie, like the entire election was stolen. And so it's the bigger the lie almost perversely makes it more credible, because they're like, nobody could possibly lie about something that big and crazy, so it must be true. So that was something Hitler latched onto. And which is a whole other thing. I think I believe I referenced in the book, but I certainly discovered when I was researching, is that Hitler was in jail. They had put Hitler in jail before he rose to power again, and they let him out. And let him out, and he became, you know, Adolf Hitler and whatnot. So as we sit here with, on the one hand, a president facing multiple criminal trials, including for the insurrection and the overthrow of this country's elected government, and you look at the severity and the extreme plans and views they have in terms of rounding people up and locking people up and anti-immigrant efforts, et cetera, that's a cautionary tale about not having the country enforce a tax on its democracy, and that there are lessons to be learned from history in that regard.
So in part one of the book, it's entitled, We Are Still in a Civil War. Part two is How We Win. And I thought you had some interesting ideas. Number one, I read Good to Great by Jim Collins many years ago. And you referenced level five leaders, that we need to nurture and have more level five leaders. And I think we both would agree, Stacey Abrams, who went to UT Austin to get her master's degree from the public school, LBJ School of Public Government. And then you also talk about the need to be data driven with a detailed plan. So you go from history, the propaganda war, to very specific examples. And no one really thought that we could win, that Biden could win Georgia in 2020. And this all goes back to the work that Stacey Abrams did. And I understand that she had a, what is it, a 40-year plan?
Yes.
For herself? Yes. Literally a 40-year plan.
Yeah.
She was the leader of the minority house at House of Representatives in Georgia. Of course, she ran for governor twice, but she was always prepared with data. And we come from an era maybe where there's a lot of community organizations, and you talk about the importance of having civic organizations, and you talk about specifically the organization in Texas, TOP. But talk about how can organizations that have been more, that have been community oriented, but really not data driven, and how organizations could sort of make that transition. What kind of leadership needs to be nurtured and developed to go from being a reactive organization to what's going on in the community, to really digging in deep on the data and nurturing and finding and nurturing level five leaders. And of course, you might need to explain, you know, for those who didn't read Good to Great, what a level five leader is.
Right. So in the second part of the book, like somebody had asked me what was I most excited about in terms of the writing the book. And I thought about it for a minute. And I was like, for all of our lives as people of color, certainly people of color in politics and on the progressive and democratic side, we've been told, yes, the people of color thing is important, but we have to win. So those issues have to take a back seat. And then as I thought about it, I was like, wait, we are winning. We have won. We have won in Harris County, Texas. We have won in Austin, Texas now. We've won in Georgia and San Diego and Virginia, Arizona. So if we want to win, let's look at how that happens. And so I looked at all those places and really tried to break down what were the common elements. And I talk about that and distilled it to what I call the Liberation Battle Plan. That has core elements. Each of these places that has gone through this transformation, each of these places that were either sympathetic to or cornerstones of the Confederacy, had level five leader, strong civic engagement organization, detailed data-driven plan, and they played the long game. Those were the elements of Liberation Battle Plan. So level five leader, I do draw from Jim Collins's book, Good to Great, where he looked at these corporations that had been successful, and he saw that all of them had what he called level five leaders who are extraordinarily ambitious and driven and disciplined and ambitious for the organization, but not for themselves. And so they did not put themselves forward, but they had extremely high standards and extremely high ambitions for their organization and for the cause. And I don't think there's anybody who more exemplifies that than Stacey Abrams. Stacey Abrams turned down the offer to run for and be a United States Senator. She could have been Warnock. That's what Chuck Schumer wanted. Chuck Schumer called me asking me to ask Stacey Abrams to run for Senate. And she's like, no, I'm going to keep building in Georgia. And I'll find somebody to run for Senate. She recruited Warnock and helped put together his team and really got him launched to where he is today. So that's and she did the work. Like when I first met Stacey, she had a 36-page plan. It was a multi-year plan for how they were going to build power within Georgia. And so those elements are all critical. And it ties back to what we talked about at the beginning about how there is now a new American majority. And that's what Obama's election I feel proved, and then lost the history too. Even though obviously Trump took the White House, Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. He has never, ever enjoyed majority support within this country. So to your question though, about how the group, so I think it's fundamentally an issue of understanding and believing that we are in fact the majority, which then dictates different strategies and tactics. So it's far less about trying to persuade people in power, appeal to people's moral conscience, which was a necessity, I think, of the era of the civil rights movement. But today, if we do the work of registering and mobilizing our voters, we can and will win. Even if people don't see it, as you said, I mean, they titled the Georgia Pact chapter, Georgia, that's not one we expected. That's a quote from Biden on election night. It says, we're ahead in Georgia. That's not one we expected, but it should have been one they expected if they had looked at the numbers and really looked at that, right? Obama, well, first of all, Jesse Jackson won the Georgia primary in 1988. Obama came within 200,000 votes of winning Georgia in 2012 without investing anything. So when I met Stacey Abrams 10 years ago, she said, there's a million unregistered voters of color in Georgia. I'm going to go register them to vote. And over the course of a decade, did that work to change the composition of the electorate to be able to actually win in 2020. So it was always very logical, but that's then becomes the imperative for the groups, is to really see that the nitty-gritty and the minutiae of doing the work of identifying, registering, and mobilizing as many progressive people, and particularly voters of color, as possible to change the composition of the electorate so that we can then win elections and change the balance of power within this country. That's the essence of how we win. And that's the essence of how we have won and how we will ultimately flip the United States Senate composition and everything that flowed from that, from the climate change legislation to $2 trillion of investments to Ketanji Brown Jackson, is because Stacey Abrams did register those people to vote, and they did elect Warnock and Ossoff, who then flipped the United States Senate and flipped the entire United States Congress's composition. And if we double down on that approach and hold fast to that, continue to try to maximize voter turnout, and the further clue to the importance of that should be the obsession that the conservatives and the right wing have around stopping people from voting, that is then how we can bring our population majority into a political majority and change the composition of this country in its direction.
So how do we build the organization here in Texas from the disintegration of ACORN? Tell that story.
So Acorn was one of the largest civic engagement organizations in the country, which got attacked by the right wing, and actually some of the Democrats and progressives were complicit by not coming to its defense when it was attacked back in 2006. But two of the people who were part of Acorn in 2006 and then to 2008 were Michelle Tremillo and Ginni Goldman. And the two of them decided they were going to create a new organization, Texas Organizing Project. And they went around, they talked to people who had been part of the whole Acorn apparatus and then other progressive activists. And they formed this new entity to do civic engagement, organizing, doing the door-to-door work and holding together the relationships in these communities of color to bring more voters of color into the electorate and to bring political power to bear. And so they created Texas Organizing Project from scratch and have built it into a multi-million dollar electoral powerhouse that has been a key engine in a lot of the progressive transformations that have occurred in the critical counties in Texas. So Harris County, Houston, electing Sylvester Turner mayor, electing a Democrat to district attorney for the first time in a long time, electing a Democrat district attorney in Bexar County, and electing progressives to two city council places in like places like San Antonio. That rose out of the ashes of what was Acorn, be through the work of originally Ginni and Michelle and the current leadership of Texas Organizing Project. Michelle has a whole team of people who work with her now who are also driving that work forward.
Steve Phillips, author of How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. Before we go, you are the founder of Democracy in Color. So if you could give us a little bit of a summary of the organization Democracy in Color.
Democracy in Color is a progressive political media organization. And I like to say we help to project the voice of the new American majority within the country. And we do a podcast ourselves every 2 weeks. People can follow that. And then we do a weekly newsletter where we offer some insight and analysis of what's happening politically, as well as point to articles and information of leaders of the new American majority in terms of things that are actually going on. And we have are also now doing, we started this recently and doing one today, regular Facebook Lives that I will do kind of calling Sundays with Steve's. That's right now, there's Sundays at 8 p.m. Eastern, where I try to answer the political questions that are going on and look at this political moment through the lens of the ongoing civil war and what are the implications of that. So democracyincolor.com, people can get the newsletter, sign up for it there. They can listen to the podcast every other Thursday through democracyincolor.com.
Steve Phillips, thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.